The lions are hungry. 2 days since they ate. I was told not to feed them, and I haven't. The queen should pay for meat. Now you take that up with her the next time she holds court, the pitmaster threw back at him.
Even now, Penny did not suspect. When she spoke about the pit, her chief worry was that more people had not laughed. They would have pissed themselves laughing if the lions had been loosed, Tyrion almost told her. Instead, he squeezed her shoulder. Penny came to a sudden halt.
We're going the wrong way.
We're not. Tyrion lowered his pails to the ground. The handles had gouged deep grooves in his fingers. Those are the tents we want there.
The second sons?
A queer smile split Ser Jorah's face.
If you think you'll find help there, you don't know Bran Ben Plum.
Oh, I do. Plum and I have played 5 games of Sylvas. Bran Ben is shrewd, tenacious, not unintelligent, but wary. He likes to let his opponent take the risks, whilst he sits back and keeps his options open, reacting to the battle as it takes shape.
Battle? What battle?
Penny backed away from him.
We have to get back. The master needs clean water. If we take too long, we'll be whipped. And Pretty Pig and Cruncher there.
Sweets will see that they are taken care of, Tyrion lied. More like Scar and his friends would soon be feasting on ham and bacon and savory dog stew. But Penny did not need to hear that. Nurse is dead, and Yezan's dying. It could be dark before anyone thinks to miss us. We will never have a better chance than now.
No. You know what they do when they catch slaves trying to escape? You know, please. They'll never let us leave the camp.
We haven't left the camp. Tyrion picked up his pails. He set off at a brisk waddle, never looking back. Mormont fell in beside him. After a moment, he heard the sounds of Penny hurrying after him, down a sandy slope to a circle of ragged tents. The first guard appeared as they neared the horse lines, a lean spearman whose maroon beard marked him as Tyroshi.
What do we have here? And what have you got in those pails?
Water, said Tyrion, if it please you.
Beer would have pleased me better.
A spear point pricked him in the back. A second guard come up behind them. Tyrion could hear King's Landing in his voice.
Scum from Flea Bottom.
You lost, dwarf,
the guard demanded.
We are here to join your company.
A pail slipped from Penny's grasp and overturned. Half the water had spilled before she could right it once again.
We've got fools enough in this company. Why would we want 3 more?
The Tyroshi flicked at Tyrion's collar with his spear point, ringing a little golden bell.
A runaway slave is what I see. 3 runaway slaves. Whose collar?
The Yellow Whale's.
That from a third man, drawn by their voices, a skinny, stubble-jaw piece of work with teeth stained red from sour leaf.
A sergeant,
Tyrion knew, from the way the other two deferred to him. He had a hook where his right hand should have been.
Bran's meaner bastard shadow, or I'm Balor the Beloved.
These are the dwarfs, Ben tried to buy,
the sergeant told the spearman, squinting.
But the big one, best bring him to, all 3.
The Tyroshi gestured with his spear. Tyrion moved along. The other sellsword, a stripling hardly more than a boy, with fuzz on his cheeks and hair the colour of dirty straw, scooped up Penny under one arm.
"Oh, mine has teats,"
he said, laughing. He slapped a hand under Penny's tunic, just to be sure.
"Just bring her,"
snapped the sergeant. The stripling slung Penny over one shoulder. Tyrion went ahead, as quick as his stunted legs would allow. He knew where they were going, the big tent on the far side of the fire pit. Its painted canvas walls cracked and faded by years of sun and rain. A few sellswords turned to watch them pass, and a camp follower sniggered, but no one moved to interfere. Within the tent they found camp's tools and a trestle table, a rack of spears and halberts, a floor covered with threadbare carpets and half a dozen clashing collars, and three officers. One was slim and elegant, with a pointed beard, a bravo's blade, and a slash pink doublet. One was plump and balding, with ink stains on his fingers and a quill clutched in one hand. The third was the man he sought. Tyrion bowed.
"Captain?"
"We caught them creeping into camp."
The stripling dumped Penny onto the carpet.
"Runaways," the Tyroshi declared, "with pails."
"Pails?" said Brown Ben Plum.
When no one ventured to explain, he said,
"Back to your post, boys, and not a word of this to anyone."
When they were gone, he smiled at Tyrion.
"Come for another game of Saivas, Yellow?"
"If you wish, I do enjoy defeating you. I hear you're twice a turncloak, Plum, a man after mine own heart."
Brown Ben's smile never reached his eyes. He studied Tyrion as a man might study a talking snake.
"Why are you here?"
"To make your dreams come true. You tried to buy us at auction. Then you tried to win us at Saivas. Even when I had my nose, I was not so handsome as to provoke such passion, save in one who happened to know my true worth. Well, here I am, free for the taking. Now be a friend. Send for your smith and get these collars off us. I'm sick of tinkling when I tinkle."
"I want no trouble with your noble master."
"Yesen has more urgent matters to concern him than three missing slaves. He's riding the pale mare. And why should they think to look for us here? You have swords enough to discourage anyone who comes nosing round. A small risk for a great gain."
The jackanapes in the slash pink doublet hissed.
"They've brought the sickness amongst us, into our very tents." He turned to Ben Plum. "Shall I cut his head off, Captain? We can toss the rest in the latrine pit."
He drew a sword, a slender bravo's blade, with a jeweled hilt.
"Do be careful with my head," said Tyrion. "You don't want to get any of my blood on you. Blood carries the disease. And you'll want to boil our clothes, or burn them."
"I've a mind to burn them with you still in them, Yellow."
"That is not my name, but you know that. You have known that since you first set eyes on me."
"Might be."
"I know you as well, my lord," said Tyrion. "You're less purple and more brown than the plums at home, but unless your name's a lie, you're a Westerman, by blood, if not by birth. House Plum is sworn to Castle Rock, and as it happens, I know a bit of its history. Your branch sprouted from a stone spit across a narrow sea, no doubt. A younger son of Viserys Plum, I'd wager. The Queen's dragons were fond of you, were they not?"
That seemed to amuse the sellsword.
"Who told you that?"
"No one. Most of the stories you hear about dragons are fodder for fools. Talking dragons, dragons hoarding gold and gems, dragons with four legs and bellies big as elephants, dragons riddling with sphinxes. Nonsense, all of it. But there are truths in the old books as well. Not only do I know that the Queen's dragons took to you, but I know why.
My mother," said my father, "had a drop of dragon blood.
Two drops, that or a cock 6 feet long. You know that tale?"
"I do."
"Now you're a clever plum, so you know this head of mine is worth a lordship, back in Westeros, half a world away. By the time you get it there, only bone and maggots will remain. My sweet sister will deny the head is mine and cheat you of the promised reward. You know how it is with queens. Fickle cunts, the lot of them, and Cersei is the worst."
Brown Ben scratched at his beard.
"Could deliver you alive and wriggling in, or pop your head into a jar and pickle it,
or throw in with me. That's the wisest move." He grinned. "I was born a second son. This company is my destiny."
"The second sons have no place for mamas,"
the bravo in pink said scornfully.
It's fighters we need.
I brought you one. Tyrion jerked a thumb at Mormont.
That creature.
The Bravo laughed.
An ugly brute. But scars alone don't make a second son.
Tyrion rolled his mismatched eyes. Lord Plum, who are these two friends of yours? The pink one is annoying.
The Bravo curled a lip, whilst the fellow with a quill chuckled at his insolence. But it was Jorah Mormont who supplied their names.
Inkpots is the company paymaster. The peacock calls himself Casporio, the cunning. Though Casporio the cunt would be more apt. Nasty piece of work.
Mormont's face might have been unrecognizable in its battered state, but his voice was unchanged. Casporio gave him a startled look, whilst the wrinkles around Plum's eyes crinkled in amusement.
Jorah Mormont? Is that you? Less proud than when you scampered off, though. Must we call you Sir?
Sir Jorah's swollen lips twisted into a grotesque grin.
Give me a sword, and you can call me what you like, Ben.
Casporio edged backward.
You... She sent you away.
I came back. Call me a fool.
A fool in love. Tyrion cleared his throat.
You can talk about times later, after I've done explaining why my head would be of more use to you upon my shoulders. You will find, Lord Plum, that I can be very generous to my friends. If you doubt me, ask Bronn, ask Shagga, son of Dolph, ask Timmit, son of Timmit.
And who would they be?
Asked the man called Inkpots.
Good men who pledged me their swords and prospered greatly by that service.
He shrugged.
Oh, very well. I lied about the good part. They're bloodthirsty bastards, like you lot.
Might be, said Brown Ben. Or might be you just made up some names. Shagga, did you say? Is that a woman's name?
His teats are big enough. Next time we meet, I'll peek beneath his breeches, to be sure. Oh, is that a Saivas set over there? Bring it out, and we'll have that game. But first, I think, a cup of wine. My throat is dry as an old bone, and I can see that I have a deal of talking to do.
John. That night he dreamt of wildlings howling from the woods, advancing to the moan of war horns and the roll of drums. Boom-boom, 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 came the sound, a thousand hearts with a single beat. Some had spears, and some had bows, and some had axes. Others rode on chariots made of bones, drawn by teams of dogs as big as ponies. Giants lumbered amongst them, 40 feet tall, with mauls the size of oak trees.
"Stand fast!" Jon Snow called. "Throw them back!"
He stood atop the wall alone.
"Flame!" he cried. "Feed them flame!"
But there was no one to pay heed. "They are all gone. They have abandoned me." Burning shafts hissed upward, trailing tongues of fire. Scarecrow brothers tumbled down, black cloaks ablaze.
"Snow!"
an eagle cried, as foemen scuttled up the ice like spiders. John was armored in black ice, but his blade burned red in his fist. As the dead men reached the top of the wall, he sent them down to die again. He slew a greybeard and a beardless boy, a giant, a gaunt man with file teeth, a girl with thick red hair. Too late, he recognized Ygritte. She was gone as quick as she'd appeared. The world dissolved into a red mist. John stabbed and slashed and cut. He hacked down Donal Noy and gutted Death Dick Thollard. Corran Halfhand stumbled to his knees, trying in vain to staunch the flow of blood from his neck.
"I am the Lord of Winterfell," John screamed.
It was Rob before him now, his hair wet with melting snow. Longclaw took his head off. Then a gnarled hand seized John roughly by the shoulder. He whirled and woke, with a raven pecking at his chest.
Snow!
The bird cried. John swatted at it. The raven shrieked its displeasure, and flapped up to a bedpost to glare down balefully at him through the pre-dawn gloom. The day had come. It was the hour of the wolf. Soon enough the sun would rise, and 4,000 wildlings would come pouring through the wall. Madness! John Snow ran his burned hand through his hair, and wondered once again what he was doing. Once the gate was opened, there would be no turning back. It should have been the old bear to treat with Tormund. It should have been Jeremy Riker, or Corin Halfhand, or Dennis Mellister, or some other seasoned man. It should have been my uncle. It was too late for such misgivings, though. Every choice had its risks, every choice its consequences. He would play the game to its conclusion. He rose and dressed in darkness, as Mormont's raven muttered across the room.
Corn,
the bird said, and
King,
and
Snow, Jon Snow, Jon Snow.
That was queer. The bird had never said his full name before, as best John could recall. He broke his fast in the cellar with his officers. Fried bread, fried eggs, blood sausages, and barley porridge made up the meal, washed down with thin yellow beer. As they ate, they went over the preparations yet again.
"All is in readiness," Bowen Marsh assured him. "If the wildlings uphold the terms of the bargain, all will go as you've commanded."
And if not, it may turn to blood and carnage. "Remember," John said, "Tormund's people are hungry, cold, and fearful. Some of them hate us as much as some of you hate them. We are dancing on rotten ice here, them and us. One crack, and we all drown. If blood should be shed today, it had best not be one of us who strikes the first blow, or I swear by the old gods and the new that I will have the head of the man who strikes it." They answered him with eyes and nods and muttered words, with, "As you command," and "It will be done," and "Yes, my lord." And one by one they rose and buckled on their swords and donned their warm black cloaks, and strode out into the cold. Last to leave the table was Dolorous Ed Tollett, who had come in during the night with 6 wagons from the Long Barrow. Horse Barrow, the Black Brothers call the fortress now. Ed had been sent to gather up as many spear wives as his wagons would hold, and bring them back to join their sisters. John watched him mop up a runny yoke with a chunk of bread. It was strangely comforting to see Ed's dour face again. "How goes the restoration work?" he asked his old steward.
10 more years should do it,"
Tollett replied, in his usual gloomy tone.
"Place was overrun with rats when we moved in. Oh, their spear wives killed the nasty buggers. Now the place is overrun with spear wives. These days I want the rats back."
"How do you find serving under Iron Emmett?" John asked.
"Mostly it's Black Maris serving under him, my lord. Me, I have the mules. Nettles claims we're kin. It's true we have the same long face, but I'm not near as stubborn. Anyway, I never knew their mothers, on my honour."
He finished the last of his eggs and sighed.
I do like me a nice runny egg. If it please me, lord, don't let the wildlings eat all our chickens."
Out in the yard, the eastern sky had just begun to lighten. There was not a wisp of cloud in sight. "We have a good day for this, it would seem," John said. "A bright day, warm and sunny."
"The wall will weep. And winter almost on us. It's unnatural, my lord. A bad sign, you ask me."
John smiled. "And if it were to snow?"
"A worse sign."
"What sort of weather would you prefer?"
The sort they keep indoors," said Dolorous Ed. "If it please, my lord, I should get back to my mules. They miss me when I'm gone, more than I can say for them spear wives."
They parted there, Tollett for the east road where his wagons waited, John Snow for the stables. Saturn had his horse saddled and bridled and waiting for him. A fiery grey courser with a mane as black and shiny as Maester's ink. He was not the sort of mount that John would have chosen for arranging, but on this morning all that mattered was that he look impressive, and for that the stallion was a perfect choice. His tail was waiting too. John had never liked surrounding himself with guards, but today it seemed prudent to keep a few good men beside him. They made a grim display in their ringmail, iron half-helms, and black cloaks, with tall spears in their hands and swords and daggers on their belts. For this John had passed over all the green boys and greybeards in his command, choosing 8 men in their prime: Ty and Molly, Left Hand Lou, Big Liddle, Rory, Fulk the Flea, Garrett Greenspear, and Leathers, Castle Black's new master-at-arms, to show the free folk that even a man who had fought for Mance in the battle beneath the wall could find a place of honour in the night's watch. A deep red blush had appeared in the east by the time they had all assembled at the gate. "The stars are going out," John thought. When next they reappeared, they would be shining down upon a world forever changed. A few Queen's men stood watching from beside the embers of Lady Melisandre's nightfire. When John glanced at the King's Tower, he glimpsed a flash of red behind a window. Of Queen Selyse he saw no sign. "It was time. Open the gate," John Snow said softly.
"Open the gate!"
Big Liddle roared. His voice was thunder. 700 feet above, the sentries heard and raised their war horns to their lips. The sound rang out, echoing off the wall and out across the world.
"Oh!"
One long blast. For 1,000 years or more, that sound had meant rangers coming home. Today it meant something else. Today it called the free folk to their new homes. On either end of the long tunnel, gates swung open and iron bars unlocked. Dawn light shimmered on the ice above, pink and gold and purple. Dolores Ed had not been wrong. The wall would soon be weeping. God grant it weeps alone. Saturn led them underneath the ice, lighting the way through the gloom of the tunnel with an iron lantern. John followed, leading his horse. Then the guardsmen. After them came Bowen Marsh and his stewards, a score of them, every man assigned a task. Above, Ulma of the Kingswood had the wall. 20 of Castle Black's best bowmen stood with him, ready to respond to any trouble down below with a rain of arrows. North of the wall, Tormund Giantsbane was waiting, mounted on a runty little garron that looked far too weedy to support his weight. His 2 remaining sons were with him, tall Torrig and young Drin, along with 30 warriors.
"Ah!" Tormund called. "Guards, is it? Now, where's the trust in that crow?"
"You brought more men than I did."
"So I did. Come here by me, lad. I want my folk to see you. I got 1,000 ne'er saw a Lord Commander, grown men who were told as boys that your rangers would eat them if they didn't behave. They need to see you plain, a long-faced lad in an old black cloak. They need to learn that the night's watch is not to be feared."
"That is a lesson I would sooner they never learned." John peeled the glove off his burned hand, put 2 fingers in his mouth, and whistled. Ghosts came racing from the gate. Tormund's horse shied so hard that the wildling almost lost his saddle.
"Naught to be feared," John said. "Ghost, stay."
"You are a black-hearted bastard, Lord Crow."
Tormund Hornblower lifted his own war horn to his lips. The sound of it echoed off the ice like rolling thunder, and the first of the free folk began to stream toward the gate. From dawn till dusk, John watched the wildlings pass. The hostages went first, 100 boys between the ages of 8 and 16.
"Your blood price, Lord Crow," Tormund declared. "I hope the wailing of their poor mothers don't haunt your dreams at night."
Some of the boys were led to the gate, by a mother or a father, others by older siblings. More came alone. 14- and 15-year-old boys were almost men and did not want to be seen clinging to a woman's skirts. Two stewards counted the boys as they went by, noting each name on long sheepskin scrolls. A third collected their valuables for the toll and wrote that down as well. The boys were going to a place that none had ever been before, to serve an order that had been the enemy of their kith and kin for thousands of years. Yet John saw no tears, heard no wailing mothers. "These are winter's people," he reminded himself. "Tears freeze upon your cheeks where they come from." Not a single hostage balked or tried to slink away when his turn came to enter that gloomy tunnel. Almost all the boys were thin, some past the point of gauntness, with spindly shanks and arms like twigs. That was no more than John expected. Elsewise they came in every shape and size and colour. He saw tall boys and short boys, brown-haired boys and black-haired boys, honey blondes and strawberry blondes and redheads kissed by fire, like Ygritte. He saw boys with scars, boys with limps, boys with pockmarked faces. Many of the older boys had downy cheeks or wispy little mustachios, but there was one fellow with a beard as thick as Tormund's. Some dressed in fine soft furs, some in boiled leather and oddments of armour, more in wool and sealskins, a few in rags. One was naked. Many had weapons, sharpened spears, stone-headed mauls, knives made of bone or stone or dragon glass, spiked clubs, tangle nets, even here and there a rust-eaten old sword. The Hornwood boys walked blithe and barefoot through the snowdrifts. Other lads had bear paws on their boots and walked on top of the same drifts, never sinking through the crust. Six boys arrived on horses, two on mules. A pair of brothers turned up with a goat. The biggest hostage was 6.5 feet tall, but had a baby's face. The smallest was a runty boy who claimed 9 years, but looked no more than 6. Of special note were the sons of men of renown. Tormund took care to point them out as they went by. "The boy there is the son of Soren Shieldbreaker," he said of one tall lad. "Him with the red hair is Gerrit Kingsblood's get. Comes of the line of Raymond Redbeard, to hear him tell it. The line of Redbeard's little brother, you want it true." Two boys looked enough alike to be twins, but Tormund insisted they were cousins, born a year apart. "One was sired by Harl the Huntsman, t'other by Harl the Handsome, both on the same woman. Fathers ate each other. I was you, I'd send one to Eastwatch and t'other to your shadow tower." Other hostages were named as sons of Howard Wanderer, of Brog, of Devon Sealskinner, Kyleg of the Wooden Ear, Mourner White Mask, the Great Walrus. The Great Walrus? Truly? They have queer names along the frozen shore. Three hostages were sons of Alfin Crowkiller, an infamous raider slain by Corran Halfhand, or so Tormund insisted. They do not look like brothers, John observed. Half-brothers, born of different mothers. Alfin's, member was a wee thing, even smaller than yours, but he was never shy with where he stuck it. Had a son in every village, that one. Of a certain runty, red-faced boy, Tormund said, "That one's a whelp, a Varamyr Sixskins. You remember Varamyr, Lord Crow?" He did. The skin-changer. "Aye, he was that. A vicious little runt besides. Dead now, like as not. No one's seen him since the battle." Two of the boys were girls in disguise. When John saw them, he dispatched Rory and Big Liddle to bring them to him. One came meekly enough, the other kicking and biting. This could end badly. "Do these two have famous fathers?"
"Ha! Them skinny things, not likely. Picked by lot."
"They're girls."
"Are they?"
Tormund squinted at the pair of them from his saddle. "Me and Lord Crow made a wager on which of you as the biggest member. Pull them breeches down. Give us a look." One of the girls turned red. The other glared defiantly.
"You leave us alone, Tormund giant stink. You let us go."
You win, Crow. Not a cock between them. The little one's got a set of balls, though. A spear wife in the making, eh?"
He called to his own men. "Go find them something girly to put on before Lord Snow wets his small clothes. I'll need two boys to take their places."
"How's that?"
Tormund scratched his beard.
"A hostage is a hostage, seems to me. That big sharp sword of yours can snick a girl's head off as easy as a boy's. A father loves his daughters, too. Well, most fathers."
"It is not their fathers who concern me. Did Mance ever sing of brave Danny Flint?"
"Not as I recall. Who was he?"
"A girl who dressed up like a boy to take the black. Her song is sad and pretty. What happened to her wasn't. In some versions of the song, her ghost still walked the night fort. I'll send the girls to Longbarrow." The only men there were Arne Emmett and Dolorous Ed, both of whom he trusted. That was not something he could say of all his brothers. The wildling understood.
"Nasty birds, you crows," he spat. "Two more boys, then. You'll have them."
When 99 hostages had shuffled by them to pass beneath the wall, Tormund Giantsbane produced the last one.
"My son, Drin. You'll see he's well taken care of, Crow, or I'll cook your black liver up and eat it."
John gave the boy a close inspection. Bran's age, or the age it would have been, if Theon had not killed him. Drin had none of Bran's sweetness, though. He was a chunky boy, with short legs, thick arms, and a wide red face, a miniature version of his father, with a shock of dark brown hair. "He'll serve as my own page," John promised Tormund.
"Hear that, Drin? See that you don't get above yourself."
To John he said,
"He'll need a good beating from time to time. Be careful of his teeth, though, he bites."
He reached down for his horn again, raised it, and blew another blast. This time it was warriors who came forward, and not just 100 of them, 500, John Snow judged, as they moved out from beneath the trees, perhaps as many as 1,000. One in every 10 of them came mounted, but all of them came armed. Across their backs they bore round wicker shields covered with hides and boiled leather, displaying painted images of snakes and spiders, severed heads, bloody hammers, broken skulls and demons. A few were clad in stolen steel, dinted oddments of armour looted from the corpses of fallen rangers. Others had armoured themselves in bones, like rattleshirt. All wore fur and leather. There were spear-wives with them, long hair streaming. John could not look at them without remembering Ygritte. The gleam of fire in her hair, the look on her face when she disrobed for him in the grotto, the sound of her voice.
"You know nothing, John Snow," she told him 100 times.
"It is as true now as it was then. You might have sent the women first," he said to Tormund, "the mothers and the maids." The wildling gave him a shrewd look.
I might have. And you, crows, might decide to close that gate. A few fighters on t'other side, well, that way the gate stays open, don't it?"
He grinned.
"I bought your bloody horse, John Snow. Don't mean that we can't count his teeth. Now don't you go thinking me and mine don't trust you. We trust you just as much as you trust us," he snorted. "You wanted warriors, didn't you? Well, there they are, every one worth 6 of your black crows."
John had to smile. "So long as they save those weapons for our common foe, I am content."
"Gave you my word on it, didn't I? The word of Tormund Giantsbane, strong as iron 'tis."
He turned and spat.
amongst a stream of warriors, were the fathers of many of John's hostages. Some stared with cold, dead eyes as they went by, fingering their sword hilts. Others smiled at him like long-lost kin, though a few of those smiles discomforted Jon Snow more than any glare. None knelt, but many gave him their oaths.
"What Tormund swore, I swear," declared black-haired Brog, a man of few words.
Sauron's shieldbreaker bowed his head an inch and growled,
"Sauron's axe is yours, Jon Snow, if ever you have need of such."
Red-bearded Garrett Kingsblood brought three daughters.
"They will make fine wives and give their husbands strong sons of royal blood," he boasted, "like their father. They are descended from Raymond Redbeard, who was king beyond the wall."
Blood meant little and less amongst the free folk, John knew. His grit had taught him that. Garrick's daughters shared her same flame-red hair, though hers had been a tangle of curls, and theirs hung long and straight. Kissed by fire. Three princesses, each lovelier than the last, he told their father. I will see that they are presented to the queen. Selyse Baratheon would take to these three better than she had to Val, he suspected. They were younger and considerably more coward. Sweet enough to look at them, though their father seems a fool. Hard Wanderer swore his oath upon his sword, as nicked and pitted a piece of iron as John had ever seen. Devin Sealskinner presented him with a sealskin hat, Harl the Huntsman with a bear-claw necklace. The warrior witch, Morna, removed her weirwood mask just long enough to kiss his gloved hand and swear to be his man, or his woman, whichever he preferred. And on and on and on. As they passed, each warrior stripped off his treasures and tossed them into one of the carts that the stewards had placed before the gate. Amber pendants, golden torques, jewel daggers, silver brooches set with gemstones, bracelets, rings, Nyello cups and golden goblets, war horns and drinking horns, a green jade comb, a necklace of freshwater pearls, all yielded up and noted down by Bowen Marsh. One man surrendered a shirt of silver scales that had surely been made for some great lord. Another produced a broken sword with three sapphires in the hilt. And there were queerer things. A toy mammoth made of actual mammoth hair. An ivory phallus. A helm made from a unicorn's head, complete with horn. How much food such things would buy in the free cities, Jon Snow could not begin to say. After the riders came the men of the frozen shore. Jon watched a dozen of their big bone chariots roll past him one by one, clattering like rattle-shirt. Half still rolled as before, others had replaced their wheels with runners. They slid across the snowdrifts, smoothly, where the wheeled chariots were foundering and sinking. The dogs that drew the chariots were fearsome beasts, as big as direwolves. Their women were clad in sealskins, some with infants at their breasts. Older children shuffled along behind their mothers and looked up at John with eyes as dark and hard as the stones they clutched. Some of the men wore antlers on their hats, and some wore walrus tusks. The two sorts did not love each other, he soon gathered. A few thin reindeer brought up the rear, with the great dogs snapping at the heels of stragglers.
"Be wary of that lot, Jon Snow," Tormund warned him. "A savage folk. The men are bad, the women worse."
He took a skin off his saddle and offered it up to John.
"Here, this will make them seem less fearsome, might be, and warm you for the night. No, go on, it's yours to keep. Drink deep."
Within was a mead so potent it made John's eyes water and sent tendrils of fire snaking through his chest. He drank deep. "You're a good man, Tormund Giants, babe, for a wildling."
"Better than most, might be. Not so good as some."
On and on the wildlings came, as the sun crept across the bright blue sky. Just before midday, the movement stopped when an oxcart became jammed at a turn inside the tunnel. John Snow went to have a look for himself. The cart was now wedge solid. The men behind were threatening to hack it apart and butcher the ox where he stood, whilst the driver and his kin swore to kill them if they tried. With the help of Tormund and his son Torrig, John managed to keep the wildlings from coming to blood, but it took the best part of an hour before the way was opened again.
"You need a bigger gate," Tormund complained to John, with a sour look up at the sky where a few clouds had blown in. "Too bloody slow this way, like sucking the milk water through a reed. Ha! Would that I had the horn of Juramund. I'd give it a nice toot, and we'd climb through the rubble."
Melisandre burned the horn of Joramund.
"Did she?" Tormund slapped his thigh and hooted. "She burned that fine big horn. Aye, a bloody sin, I call it. 1,000 years old, that was. We found it in a giant's grave, and no man of us had ever seen a horn so big. That must have been why Mance got the notion to tell you it were Joramund's. He wanted you crows to think he had it in his power to blow your bloody wall down about your knees. But we never found the true horn, not for all our digging. If we had, every kneeler in your 7 kingdoms would have chunks of ice to cool his wine all summer."
John turned in his saddle, frowning. And Joramund blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. That huge horn, with its bands of old gold, incised with ancient runes. Had Mance Rayder lied to him? Or was Tormund lying now? If Mance's horn was just a feint, where is the true horn? By afternoon the sun had gone, and the day turned grey and gusty. "A snow sky," Tormund announced grimly. Others had seen the same omen in those flat white clouds. It seemed to spur them on to haste. Tempers began to fray. One man was stabbed when he tried to slip in ahead of others who had been hours in the column. Tareg wrenched the knife away from his attacker, dragged both men from the press, and sent them back to the wildling camp to start again. "Tormund," John said, as they watched 4 old women pull a cart full of children toward the gate, "tell me of our foe. I would know all there is to know of the others." The wildling rubbed his mouth.
"Not here," he mumbled. "Not this side of your wall."
The old man glanced uneasily toward the trees in their white mantles.
"They're never far, you know. They won't come out by day. Not when that old sun's shining. But don't think that means they went away. Shadows never go away. Might be you don't see them, but they're always clinging to your heels."
"Did they trouble you on your way south?"
"They never came in force, if that's your meaning. But they were with us, all the same, nibbling at our edges. We lost more outriders than I care to think about, and it was worth your life to fall behind or wander off. Every nightfall, we'd ring our camps with fire. They don't like fire much, and no mistake. When the snows came, though, snow and sleet and freezing rain, it's bloody hard to find dry wood or get your kindling lit. And the cold, oh, some nights our fires just seem to shrivel up and die.
Nights like that, you always find some dead come the morning, lest they find you first. The night that Torwin, my boy,
Tormund turned his face away.
"I know," said John Snow.
Tormund turned back.
"You know nothing. You killed a dead man, I heard. Mance killed 100. A man can fight the dead. But when their masters come, when the white mists rise up, how do you fight a mist crow? Shadows with teeth, air so cold it hurts to breathe, like a knife inside your chest. You do not know, you cannot know. Can your sword cut cold?"
"We will see," John thought, remembering the things that Sam had told him, the things he'd found in his old books, Longclaw had been forged in the fires of old Valyria, forged in dragon flame, and set with spells. Dragon steel, Sam called it, stronger than any common steel, lighter, harder, sharper. But words in a book were one thing. The true test came in battle. "You are not wrong," John said. "I do not know. And if the guards are good, I never will." "The guards are seldom good, Jon Snow." Tormund nodded towards the sky. "The clouds roll in. Already it grows darker, colder. Your wall no longer weeps, look." He turned and called out to his son, Torric. "Ride back to the camp and get them moving. The sick ones and the weak ones, the slugger beds and cravens, get them on their bloody feet. Set their bloody tents afire, if you must. The gate must close at nightfall. Any man not through the wall by then, at best pray the others get to him afore I do. You hear?"
"I hear."
Torric put his heels into his horse and galloped back down the column. On and on the wildlings came. The day grew darker, just as Tormund said. Clouds covered the sky from horizon to horizon, and warmth fled. There was more shoving at the gate, as men and goats and bullocks jostled each other out of the way. It is more than impatience, John realized. They are afraid. Warriors, spear-wives, raiders, they are frightened of those woods, of shadows moving through the trees. They want to put the wall between them before the night descends. A snowflake danced upon the air, then another. "Dance with me, Jon Snow," he thought. "You'll dance with me anon." On and on and on the wildlings came. Some were moving faster now, hastening across the battleground. Others, the old, the young, the feeble, could scarce move at all. This morning the field had been covered with a thick blanket of old snow, its white crust shining in the sun. Now the field was brown and black and slimy. The passage of the free folk had turned the ground to mud and muck. Wooden wheels and horses' hooves, runners of bone and horn and iron, pig trotters, heavy boots, the cloven feet of cows and bullocks, the bare black feet of the hornwood folk, all had left their marks. The soft footing slowed the column even more.
"You need a bigger gate,"
Tormund complained again. By late afternoon the snow was falling steadily, but the river of wildlings had dwindled to a stream. Columns of smoke rose from the trees where their camp had been.
"Torric," Tormund explained, "burning the dead. Always some will go to sleep and don't wake up. You find them in their tents, them as have tents, curled up and froze. Torric knows what to do."
The stream was no more than a trickle by the time Torric emerged from the wood. With him rode a dozen mounted warriors armed with spears and swords. "My rear guard," Tormund said, with a gap-toothed smile.
"You crows have rangers, so do we. Them I left in camp, in case we were attacked before we all got out.
Your best men,
or my worst. Every man of them has killed a crow."
Amongst the riders came one man afoot, with some big beast trotting at his heels. A boar, John saw, a monstrous boar, twice the size of Ghost. The creature was covered with coarse black hair, with tusks as long as a man's arm. John had never seen a boar so huge or ugly. The man beside him was no beauty either. Hulking, black-browed, he had a flat nose, heavy jowls, dark with stubble, small black close-set eyes.
"Borok!"
Tormund turned his head and spat. A skin changer? It was not a question. Somehow he knew. Ghost turned his head. The falling snow had masked the boar's scent, but now the white wolf had the smell. He padded out in front of John, his teeth bared in a silent snarl.
"No!" John snapped. "Ghost, down! Stay! Stay!"
"Boars and wolves," said Tormund. "Best keep that beast of yours locked up tonight.
I'll see that Boric does the same with his pig."
He glanced up at the darkening sky.
"Them's the last, and none too soon. It's going to snow all night, I feel it. Time I had a look at what's on t'other side of all that ice."
"You go ahead," John told him. "I mean to be the last one through the ice. I will join you at the feast."
"Feast? Ha-ha! Ah, that's a word I like to hear."
The wildling turned his garum toward the wall and slapped her on the rump. Tarig and the riders followed, dismounting by the gate to lead their horses through. Bowen Marsh stayed long enough to supervise, as his stewards pulled the last carts into the tunnel. Only John Snow and his guards were left. The skin changer stopped 10 yards away. His monster pawed at the mud, snuffling. A light powdering of snow covered the boar's humped black back. He gave a snort and lowered his head. And for half a heartbeat, John thought he was about to charge. To either side of him, his men lowered their spears.
"Brother," Boric said, "you'd best go on. We're about to close the gate."
"Ye do that," Boric said. "Ye close it good and tight. They're coming, crow."
He smiled as ugly a smile as John had ever seen, and made his way to the gate. The boar stalked after him. The falling snow covered up their tracks behind them.
"That's done, then,"
Rory said when they were gone. "No," thought John Snow, "it has only just begun." Bowen Marsh was waiting for him south of the wall, with a tablet full of numbers.
3,119 wildlings passed through the gate today,"
the Lord Steward told him.
60 of your hostages were sent off to East Watch and the Shadow Tower after they'd been fed. Ed Tollett took 6 wagons of women back to Long Barrow. The rest remain with us."
"Not for long," John promised him. "Tormund means to lead his own folk to Oakenshield within a day or two. The rest will follow, as soon as we sort where to put them."
"As you say, Lord Snow."
The words were stiff. The tone suggested that Bowen Marsh knew where he would put them. The castle John returned to was far different from the one he'd left that morning. For as long as he had known it, Castle Black had been a place of silence and shadows, where a meager company of men in black moved like ghosts amongst the ruins of a fortress that had once housed 10 times their numbers. All that had changed. Lights now shone through windows where Jon Snow had never seen light shine before. Strange voices echoed down the yards, and free folk were coming and going along icy paths that had only known the black boots of crows for years. Outside the old flint barracks, he came across 12 men pelting one another with snow. "Playing," John thought in astonishment. "Grown men, playing like children, throwing snowballs the way Bran and Arya once did, and Rob and me before them." Donald Noy's old armory was still dark and silent, however, and John's rooms, back of the coal forge, were darker still. But he had no sooner taken off his cloak than Danil poked his head through the door to announce that Clydes had brought a message.
"Send him in."
John lit a taper from an ember in his brazier, and 3 candles from the taper. Clydes entered, pink and blinking, the parchment clutched in one soft hand.
"I beg pardon, Lord Commander. I know you must be weary, but I thought you would want to see this at once."
"You did well." John read. "At hard home, with 6 ships, wild seas, Blackbird lost with all hands, 2 Lyseni ships driven aground on Skane, Talon taking water, very bad here, wildlings eating their own dead, dead things in the woods. Bravassi captains will only take women, children on their ships. Witch women call us slavers. Attempt to take Stormcrow defeated. 6 crew dead. Many wildlings. 8 ravens left. Dead things in the water. Send help by land. seas racked by storms. From Talon, by hand of Maester Harmoon. Cutter Pike had made his angry mark below.
"Is it grievous, my lord?"
asked Clydes. "Grievous enough. Dead things in the wood. Dead things in the water. 6 ships left of the 11 that set sail." Jon Snow rolled up the parchment, frowning. "Night falls," he thought, "and now my war begins." The Discarded Knight.
"All kneel for his magnificence, his Dars O'Lorik, 14th of that noble name, King of Meereen, Scion of Gis, Octarch of the old empire, Master of the Skarhazadan, Consort to Dragons, and Blood of the Harpy,"
roared the herald. His voice echoed off the marble floor and rang amongst the pillars. Sebastian Selmy slipped a hand beneath the fold of his cloak and loosened his sword in its scabbard. No blades were allowed in the presence of the king, save those of his protectors. It seemed as though he still counted amongst that number, despite his dismissal. No one had tried to take his sword, at least. Daenerys Targaryen had preferred to hold court from a bench of polished ebony, smooth and simple, covered with the cushions that Ser Barristan had found to make her more comfortable. King Hisdar had replaced the bench with 2 imposing thrones of gilded wood, their tall backs carved into the shape of dragons. The king seated himself in the right-hand throne, with a golden crown upon his head and a jeweled scepter in one pale hand. The second throne remained vacant.
"The important throne," thought Ser Barristan. "No dragon chair can replace a dragon, no matter how elaborately it's carved."
To the right of the twin thrones stood Gogor the giant, a huge hulk of a man with a brutal, scarred face. To the left was the spotted cat, a leopard skin flung over one shoulder. Back of them were Bellaquo Bonebreaker and the coal-eyed Kras.
"Seasoned killers all," thought Selmy. "But it is one thing to face a foe in the pit when his coming is heralded by horns and drums, and another to find a hidden killer before he can strike."
The day was young and fresh, and yet he felt bone-tired, as if he'd fought all night. The older he got, the less sleep Ser Barristan seemed to need. As a squire, he could sleep 10 hours a night, and still be yawning when he stumbled out onto the practice yard. At 63, he found that 5 hours a night was more than enough. Last night he had scarce slept at all. His bedchamber was a small cell off the queen's apartments, originally slave quarters. His furnishings consisted of a bed, a chamber pot, a wardrobe for his clothing, even a chair should he want to sit. On a bedside table he kept a beeswax candle and a small carving of the warrior. Though he was not a pious man, the carving made him feel less alone here in this queer, alien city, and it was to that he had turned in the black watches of night.
"Shield me from these doubts that gnaw at me," he had prayed, "and give me the strength to do what is right."
But neither prayer nor dawn had brought him certainty. The hall was as crowded as the old knight had ever seen it, but it was the missing faces that Barristan Selmy noted most. Missandei, Belwas, Grey Worm, Aggo and Jogo and Ricaro, Iri and Jikri, Dario Naharis. In the shavepate's place stood a fat man in a muscled breastplate and lion's mask, his heavy legs poking out beneath a skirt of leather straps. Markhaz O'Lorik, the king's cousin, new commander of the Brazen Beasts. Selmy had already formed a healthy contempt for the man. He had known his sort in King's Landing, fawning to his superiors, harsh to his inferiors, as blind as he was boastful, and too proud by half.
"Scarhaz could be in the hall as well,"
Selmy realized. That ugly face of his concealed behind a mask.